This next segment is a special CFRU 93.3 FM presentation. On Saturday, May 14th, the University of Guelph hosted a forum called Revering the Seed, where the keynote speaker was Bruno Saskatchewan farmer Percy Schmeiser. Farming since 1947, Percy and his wife Louise have been catapulted to the head of a very important debate concerning the genetic ownership of seed and, in general, the right to patent all life forms, a battle being spurred by huge multinational corporations such as Monsanto. In 1998, Percy was given a letter from Monsanto stating that he had saved and used Monsanto seed on his farm. Percy and his wife were both well-known seed savers and acknowledged the huge importance of organic farming on both the land and the nutrients that subsequently come from finding natural ways of growing canola and other crops. To be thrown into such a lawsuit was devastating on the Schmeiser family, citing the hundreds of thousands of dollars spent on their defense thus far. But the battle has not been entirely immobilizing, as Percy now travels the world speaking to this very pressing issue to huge crowds of people also concerned about the extent to which Monsanto and other genetic manufacturers and patent holders are having over the seed source and subsequently the entire food supply. Percy is introduced here by University of Guelph's own anti-GMO activist, Associate Professor Anne Clark.
We're very pleased to be able to call on Professor Anne Clark, Associate Professor in Plant Agriculture at our own university here. It's a great pleasure to have her be able to introduce Percy. Anne has an interest in GM questions. Welcome, Anne.
Great to see such a great turnout here. This is super. I'm going to applaud you. That's great. It's an honor and a privilege to introduce Percy Schmeiser to you. Percy and Louise Schmeiser have, in my opinion, more than earned the title of honest, genuine Canadian heroes. We need more heroes, and it's great to actually know people that really are heroes. In a time when many people are watching their world slip away, and they're feeling more and more disempowered through the forces of globalization, Walmartization of their world. Net farm income is now below zero in Canada. Did you know that? Net farm income in Canada is now below zero. It has been for the last 2 years. It's time to honor and affirm a Canadian family that has stood up against Monsanto, and I will argue they won. And let me explain that in a little more depth. I really feel privileged to be living at a time that this all happened, because I think that this is a legacy that is going to be in the history books, and that school children in the future will read about and learn about this marvelous example of personal courage and integrity in the face of overwhelming odds, and that it actually worked in the end. Now, I just want to quickly go through a few of the facts of this case, just as a lead into what Percy is going to say, because there has been a fair effort at disinformation. So just because he's a humble guy and he's not going to say this about himself, I'm going to say it, and I will be drawing directly from the court records on this. Just to provide a little bit of fact. Okay, so he was investigated, as you've heard about, by Monsanto. The first point to understand is that all allegations of brown bagging, you know what brown bagging is? Brown bagging is theft, where you go and take seed, in this case, a genetically modified seed, that you are not paying Monsanto or the privilege to use. If you take it fraudulently, if you steal it, you buy it from a neighbor under the counter, you're not paying Monsanto the royalty, it's called brown bagging. This was the original allegation of Monsanto about the Schmeiser family, and all of those allegations were withdrawn prior to the start of the first trial. And the reason was there was just no evidence to support it. So, point number one, he didn't steal the seed. There's no evidence that he stole the seed. And that allegation was withdrawn. It was never even considered by the judges in this case, at any level, because it was not an issue. So he was genuinely an innocent bystander. How it got there, they never dealt with. That's an important omission. But he was an innocent bystander, so he didn't steal the seed. And this is a matter of court record, although you do hear a lot of noise otherwise. Monsanto, in the absence of evidence that they could charge him with, came up with a really startling alternative allegation, which was that no matter how the seed got there, he was guilty of patent infringement. And that is a particularly alarming statement for any farmer, or I would suggest any gardener, because Monsanto has just bought out Ciminus. And Ciminus is the world's largest producer of vegetable seed. So a lot of that vegetable seed that you buy when you go to the grocery store, or you go to a seed house or whatever, it's all produced by Ciminus, which is now owned by Monsanto. So the same problem will pertain to you as pertain to farmers. So just because it's there, whether you use it or not, that was the other thing that was so bizarre in this. You're guilty of patent infringement even if you didn't know it was there, and it's there. Whether you engage the utility of the gene, whether you use it by spraying Roundup in his case or not, which he didn't do, you're still guilty of patent infringement. That was the allegation. Why this is so alarming is there's about a million ways that seed can move, that pollen can move, that genes can move. Genes were made to move. Sort of like those boots are made for walking. Well, genes were made to move. So getting that stuff in your crop, in your garden, on your soil, any of that is very, very easy. And to say that just because it's there, when you didn't want it and you couldn't stop it, anyway, is really quite disturbing. So that was the allegation. Another point that there's been misinformation on was that he sprayed his field with Roundup. He did not spray his 1,000 and some acres with Roundup. He sprayed a 3-acre piece of a field because he was curious to see how far out into the field the contamination stretched. But that's the extent of the use of Roundup on this farm. Herbicide receipts were shown in court to demonstrate that he used his normal range of herbicides. He did not use Roundup. There was no evidence. This was unchallenged in court because there was no evidence that he bought Roundup to spray on 1,000 acres. So you may hear people saying that. That is not true. He did not spray Roundup on the farm, therefore did not use the one and only thing that that gene does, which is confer tolerance to Roundup. The other point to make is, as has been said, he is a seed saver, a lifelong seed saver. And if you're not into farming or gardening a lot, you may not grasp this point. But I want to emphasize that what that means is you have a single contamination event, any kind of event, and your seed is permanently contaminated. So all you have to have is the wind pick up a neighbor's windrowed canola and drop it on your farm, or a single wind blows pollen onto your farm, or you buy a sack of non-GM canola that's contaminated, which it is. It is impossible to buy non-GM seed that's guaranteed to be pure anymore. Any one of these numbers of ways it happens, if you're saving seed from that, which he does, then your seed is permanently contaminated. And by Monsanto's reasoning, you're permanently a patent infringer. You're permanently in violation. Now, why did I say he won when the headlines all said he lost? He won 2 out of 3 of the points of the decisions that the judges made, and he lost the third one by a single vote. Did you know that? You know what the 3 issues were that were decided? Number one, it is standard for the loser in these cases to have to pay the legal fees of the winner. And that's not unique to Schmeisser, that's normal. That's the way they always do it. Well, in this case, clearly reflecting the split nature of the decision, he did not have to pay Monsanto's legal bills. And that was critical because they'd already taken a lien out on his house, on his farm, on his business. And if the judges had not decided that, he and his wife would have been out on the street. And they were ready to act that same day. I have this from his lawyer. So that was an enormous savings to the Schmeiser family. The second point is even more important, and this is important to everyone. Because he did not engage the utility of this gene, because he did not spray Roundup, he was not liable for paying any portion of the value of that crop to Monsanto. And this is a very important decision. Because the third point, which was that he nonetheless was guilty of patent infringement because the gene was present on his farm, even though we didn't get it there himself, even though we didn't use it, which is very contradictory. Nonetheless, what that means then is if this stuff shows up on your farm or in your garden, so long as you don't spray the Roundup to engage the utility of the gene, you may be guilty of patent infringement, but Monsanto cannot come after you for the value of your crop. That's a very important distinction. So that second point, that second decision, essentially cuts the knees out of the decision on patent infringement. So technically you're guilty of patent infringement, financially it doesn't mean diddly. And that's a really, really important distinction. So I would argue that this is a family that in fact won. And this is a true David and Goliath story. So regardless of what the headlines say, they won. They won in court in many respects, in my opinion. And the other thing that I don't think Percy has gotten credit for, but he should have, is he has widened the circle of people knowledgeable about this case way beyond the farming community. He's given thousands of talks all around the planet, year after year after year, and all kinds of people know about what Monsanto is doing that would never have known if he hadn't had the courage and the speaking ability and the stamina to go around and do what he's done. He's like a one-man Amnesty International. The world is watching, and I think that's made a difference. And with that, Percy.
Well, thank you very much, Anne, for the great introduction. And it's really a pleasure for me to come back to this part of Ontario. I've spent a lot of time in southern Ontario the last couple of years, but this is my first chance to come here and also to Toronto last night to speak. I might maybe just go a little bit more into about my past and what I have been doing. But first of all, I would like to thank the organizers for bringing me here. And what I'm going to say today is not something that what can happen or may happen, but what has happened since regulatory approval was given by the government to Monsanto in 1996 for the introduction of GMOs. So there are many, many areas that I would like to touch on, but I think I'm going to single out some of the most important ones. But before I do that, is that, as Anna said, my wife and I were known as seed developers in canola. And when I took over the farm from my father in 1947, I immediately went into the raising of rapeseed, or canola as it is known today. And I really loved growing canola. When my wife and I were married in 1952, she came from a farm background, and she immediately took over a lot of the research and development in canola seeds and plants. And what happened with that is that the corporations, the companies, the seed companies would say that you could only plant canola once in the same land every 4 years. And by the time we hit the late 80s, we were able to seed canola in the same land year after year after year because we had overcome some of the two major diseases, Hirundina and blackleg. And so we were, this is what we call back to back. And so we had overcome that. So that was what we had accomplished in seed, natural seed breeding. Now, besides being a farmer, I was also, for a time, a member of the provincial legislature, and I was on many agricultural committees, both on the provincial level, and then also representing the province of Saskatchewan on the federal level, on agricultural policies, rules, laws, and regulations. And I always felt that I always worked for farmers' rights, laws, rules, and regulations that would benefit them. Besides being also an MLA, I was also mayor of my community for over a quarter century, and I'm still deputy mayor because I don't have time to be mayor now. But so I've been always involved in public life, especially in the field of agriculture, because I came from a rural constituency. So that gives you a brief background. Now, to just go into a little bit more of my case, which Anne has spoken about, is that the lawsuit was launched against me in 1998. And at that time, my wife had never any contact with Monsanto. We had never bought their seed. We had never went to a Monsanto meeting. I didn't even know a Monsanto rep. So it came as a real surprise when that lawsuit was launched. And it took 2 years, a pretrial, before it went to the main trial. And as Anna said, Monsanto withdrew all allegations that I ever obtained the seed illegally. But there was a couple of other reasons why we stood up to Monsanto at that time. First of all, we realized they had contaminated something that my wife and I had developed over half a century. But the other thing we realized was that we felt that farmers never ever should lose the right to use their own seed from year to year. Because if that would happen, then farmers would just become serfs of the land and you're back to a feudal system. That was one reason. As seed developers, we realized that if farmers' choice to develop their own seeds and plants were taken away and eventually all seeds and plants got contaminated, you would stop the future development of seeds and plants. Now, my wife and I, as I said, were developing seeds or canola suitable for our climatic and soil conditions for the area east of Saskatoon, central Saskatchewan, maybe 100 miles away or across the border into Montana, Alberta, or Manitoba. It may not have done as well because of different soil and climatic conditions. And we felt that right, we would stop that future and new development. And if I look back to a lot of the wheat varieties and other varieties of seeds and plants that were developed by farmers on the prairies, that's where the main source of new seeds and plants came from. So that was one of the main reasons that we stood up to Monsanto. Now, as was said, I lost the first battle, then it went to the Federal Court of Appeal, and often I wish at the first trial I could have had a judge and jury. Because patent laws come under federal law, I didn't have that choice, one judge. And I'm sure if I could have had a jury with farmers on that knew and understood farming, knew about cross-pollination and direct seed movement, it would have ended there. But it was not to be. And the Federal Court of Appeal, which I was successful to get them to hear it, I had three judges now. And but the scope of what they would judge was very narrow. Points of law, facts of law, or where the trial judge erred in law. And I was very disappointed when that ruling came down against me, where they said they did not agree with all of the first trial judge's decision, but they still upheld it. Now, when this Federal Court of Appeal didn't agree with all of the trial judge's decision, it should have been thrown out because it could have had a major impact on the final judgment. So I lost number two, round number two. It was a disappointing time in our lives because we had spent well in excess of $300,000. And, you know, to get the Supreme Court to hear it was a pretty slim chance. In fact, my lawyer said about 10%. And my wife and I finally made a decision that we would mortgage our farm and put everything on the line, everything that we owned, and apply to the Supreme Court. and we were successful in getting the Supreme Court to hear the case. In the Supreme Court, we were able to bring other issues in besides the patent infringement. And this is what all of what we brought in. Number one, Monsanto doesn't. Number one, can living organisms, seeds, plants, genes, human organs be owned and protected by corporate patents on intellectual property? Number two, can genetically modified traits invade, become noxious weeds, that then become to or become resistant to weed killers, which we now call super weeds back on the prairies? Number three, can farmers' right to grow conventional or organic crops be protected? And another one, number four, can farmers keep the ancient right to save and use your own seed? And number five, by that time, one of the most important issues to Louise, or my wife and myself, was who owns life? Who has the right to be able to patent life? And that became a very important issue to us. So those were the issues that were before the Supreme Court. The decision came down in May the 21st, almost a year ago. And as Anna said, what the decisions were. But what bothered us the most, when the Supreme Court ruled that Monsanto's patent on a gene is valid, and as was said, it doesn't matter how it gets into any higher life form, they own and control that life form. And then the question I would like to ask, if that life form or that gene gets into any life form, a seed or plant, where do you really stop? A bird, a bee, an animal, a fish, and ultimately a human being. These are some major questions that will have to be addressed by the Parliament of Canada, and the Supreme Court judges alluded to that, that that case should have never been there. It should have been addressed by the Parliament of Canada many years ago. So that is basically the issue that I face. Now, there are many issues that I would like to touch on, but I'll go what I feel is the most important ones. What has happened after the introduction of GMOs in 1996? Now, some of the issues are this. Property rights of farmers, the intellectual property rights of multinationals, the health and food issue, the environmental issue, the control of farmers through contracts, their loss of freedom of speech and expression, the culture of fear, and I'm really going to touch on that, the culture of fear that exists now, not only on the plains of the prairies of Western Canada, but also on the northern plains of the United States. The pharma plants, which we refer to, where prescription-type drugs are now being produced by plants in the open, and I will touch definitely on that. GMO rice, the moral and ethical issue with the introduction of GMOs, the trespassing and stealing of farmer seeds and plants. And basically, these corporations now are exercising more power and more control over people than any government would dare to do. And they can get away with it. So those are some of the issues that I will touch on. Now, I think that I'll go into an issue that I'm very concerned about, and that is the issue of contracts and how Monsanto, through contracts, are controlling the lives and freedom of farmers. I have a contract, and this is one I use the most. There's also a new one out in the United States. To me, this is one of the most vicious contracts on the face of the earth, taking rights of farmers away. Some of the clauses. Number one, a farmer cannot use his own seed. Number two, you must always buy the seed from Monsanto. Number three, you can only use chemicals from Monsanto. Number four, you must pay Monsanto a $15 tech fee or license fee each year on each acre. Another clause, if a farmer commit some violation of this contract, he must sign a non-disclosure statement. He can't tell his neighbor, he couldn't speak to the press. If Monsanto made him destroy his crop, took all the profits from his crop, he can't say a word. Another clause, you must permit Monsanto's police force. We call them Gene Police on the prairies. And they're former ex-Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They can come onto your land without your permission. They can go into your granaries, get your tax records, your farm records, with or without your permission. And you must permit them to do that for 3 years. They can do that for 3 years, even though you signed the contract for 1 year. And another clause they have added this past year is that a farmer now can never take Monsanto to court. You can never sue Monsanto. So that gives them total control over the farmer. That's one thing. So that is the contract. Oh, and there's many other items in that contract. One is that a farmer always is liable if you grow them a canola 1 year and you have volunteers 1 year or 5 years down the road, at your expense, you must always remove the volunteers. So you're responsible for all that expense for how many years, we don't know. So again, another item in that contract. How does Monsanto police that contract? Here's another brochure taken from Monsanto's advertisement. And it's in their daily, like in farm papers and so on. And on the bottom, there's a paragraph. And it reads, if you think your neighbor is growing Monsanto's GMO canola or soybeans, whatever the case, without a license, you should inform on your neighbor. And if a farmer happens to do that to his neighbor, reports it to Monsanto, he gets a free leather jacket from Monsanto. I'm not kidding you. And there's the farmers now are not wearing Monsanto's jacket because we could now call them squealer jackets. So, but what happens when Monsanto gets this Kipper rumor? They immediately send two of their we call them investigators, out to a farmer's home. And the first thing of many, many farmers that I've talked to, the first thing they say is, we are ex-RCMP. And a lot of times the farmers don't hear the X, they just hear the police. And they think, my God, what have we done wrong? So they'll say to a farmer or his wife, we have this Tipper rumor that you're growing Monsanto's GMO canola without a license. And a farmer will reply, no, we're organic farmers. We're conventional farmers. We've never bought your seed. And they'll say to a farmer, you're lying. If you don't confess, we'll get you. We'll drag you through the court system, and you won't have a farm left. And many times they have said to farmers, and we'll do to you the same as we're doing to Percy Schmeiser, and we'll totally destroy you. So you can imagine, when these gene police leave a farmer's home, what do you think goes through a farmer's mind? Was it this neighbor here, or this neighbor over here, or this neighbor down the road here that has caused me all this trouble? So now you have a breakdown of our world society, because people are not trusting one another and not telling farmers over on Coffee Row what they're seeding. So this is the breakdown of our world social fabric. And to me, I think that is one of the worst things that could happen with Monsanto's contract.
We will return shortly to Percy Schmeiser's talk on GMOs and seed patents. This has been a special CFRU 93.3 FM presentation called Revering the Seed, a forum on genetically modified organisms and how they have affected one Bruno Saskatchewan farmer and catapulted the GMO debate into every corner of both the farming community and into the hearts and minds of consumers everywhere. For more information about Percy and his fight with Monsanto, or to help support the legal fund that he and his wife are in, go to his website, www.percyschmeiser.com. We will now return to Percy's talk.
And I often think back to my own family. My grandparents left Europe around the 1890s, and they came first to the United States and then up to Saskatchewan. And my parents and my grandparents had to work together to build our country, our infrastructure, our schools, roads, hospitals, and so on. Now you have that breakdown of that world social fabric. That is what's going on, not in some third world country, but here in Canada. What else do they do? If they can't find a farmer at home and they have his mailing address, farmers call these extortion letters. We don't know how many thousands of these have been sent out. But believe me, In my opinion, if anybody says something negative about Monsanto, guaranteed you're going to get a letter like this from them. Basically, it states this: we have reason to believe that you might be growing Monsanto's GMO canola on 250 acres, 300 acres, whatever. And in lieu of us not taking you to court, send us $200,000, $100,000 by a certain date, and we may or may not take you to court. Another clause here, you're not allowed to show this letter to anyone. So what do you think goes through a farmer's mind when you get a letter like this from a multi-billion dollar corporation, send us $100,000 by a certain date because we think you might be growing it and we won't take you to court? That is where that whole fear comes in. Is it still going on? Yes, a letter here sent to a farmer on December the 7th, 2004. And this is one of the most brazen ones because the farmer had disagreement with Monsanto on what they accused him of growing and what acres. And basically this letter says it's in your best interest to settle with Monsanto on their terms, otherwise if you want to keep farming in the future. In other words, if you don't settle with us, we'll destroy you and you won't be able to farm in the future. That is what's going on. Another item is this. If they can't find a farmer at home and they don't know his mailing address, they can go to the local municipality office and get the farmer's location. And then they'll use a small plane or a helicopter and they'll fly over the center of a farmer's canola field. And normally our fields are 160 acres. And they'll drop a Monsanto Roundup herbicide spray bomb. And then they'll come back within about 10 or 12 days as the Roundup herbicide has time to activate. And they'll look to see what has happened. If the crop has died, if the canola crop has died, and normally it'll cover about 30 feet, if the crop has died, they know the farmer was not using Monsanto's GMO canola. If the crop has not died after being hit with Roundup, they know the farmer was using Monsanto's GMO canola. Those are the methods and tactics they use to check on farmers. We don't know how many thousands of acres, but one important case that even appeared on CBC was a quarter of land where the farmer was draining his water for drinking water into his drinking water supply. So he was very concerned. So they don't care what they do. They'll go in any farmer's field they choose without farmer's permission. And I'm not scared to use the word steal farmer's seeds or plants, depending on the state of growth, for testing. And if a farmer catches them in his field and says, hey, get out, you're trespassing, you're stealing, and they'll laugh at a farmer and say, make us. And a farmer may say, well, I'm going to take you to court. And they'll say, take us to court, but we'll guarantee you by the time we're through with you in court, you won't have a farmland. And when farmers hear what it costs me and my wife to stand up to them, they just give in. We don't know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars. We know that already on the documented cases, Monsanto has collected over $15 million already from farmers, fining farmers for that, because farmers know they don't have a chance. So if they have to pay $50,000, it's better than go to court and give 5 years, than rather than spend 5 years of your life. Those are some of the things that Monsanto does. And so that's the other side of the story, besides the issue of food, environment, and so on. The other area I would like to go into is this. Number one, there is no such thing as containment. And we as farmers know that, and many people know that. You can't contain a gene once it's released into the environment. You can't stop pollen flow. You can't stop direct seed movement by whatever means, some of the biggest ones is the wind on the prairies, but also farmers hauling their grain to market, or seeding, or harvesting when they're hauling the grain from their combines into their granaries or silos. So there is no such thing as containment. And when the companies tell you, well, you can contain it. And I remember how many times at the beginning they said, all you have to do is leave a 3-meter buffer strip Well, good Lord, one farmer said to me he could spit farther than 10 feet, you know. So there is no such thing as containment. And with that then, if you can't contain it, there's no such thing as coexistence. Believe me, the GMO gene is a dominant gene, and it will take over whatever species of seeds or plants it gets into. So when the companies say farmers have a choice, any place that introduces GMOs, your choice is taken away. Like the organic farmers found out back home, they no longer can raise conventional or organic canola or soybeans. All our seed supplies are now contaminated. So choice is gone. You no longer have a choice. Now, here is another point that the judge, the first trial judge, ruled. He said, I ought to or should have known that my seeds or plants were contaminated. And he also ruled I was not allowed to use my seeds or plants again, even though we had developed them over half a century. And he also ordered up all our seeds and plants that we may have left goes to Monsanto. So basically, Monsanto got 50 years of research and development for nothing. And another important point he ruled, he said a farmer may or may not own his seeds or plants if they get contaminated. And then he went on to say, but it's not for him to use. So you may own or you may not own your seeds or plants when they get contaminated, but it's not for you to use. So where does that stop? If you are growing a GMO seed or plant, or raising a plant or food, that means under the contract, you cannot even use a GMO product, food or plant, for your own use, because you violate Monsanto's patent, because you cannot use, you must return everything to Monsanto. So what will happen in the future at our universities? How can you do any, our students and graduates, do any more research? Because you'd have to pay a license fee to Monsanto or any other company that has a patent to do that research. Then, after you do the research, you would not own that results of that research. It would go to a company that has the patent on it. Now, I'll give you an example of this. At the Supreme Court hearing, I had interveners from around the world. But one of the interveners, which I was very surprised, was the government of Ontario on my behalf. And that was in regards to breast cancer treatment, healthcare. It was from the Department of Health. Because when you use breast cancer treatment, one of the breast cancer treatments, two of the genes are already patented. So when you use that treatment, you must pay a license fee to a company based in Salt Lake City, Utah. Now say, for instance, the government of Ontario decided to further research on that breast cancer treatment. You can't do it unless you pay a license fee to this company. And if you find, or from your research, you find a better way or better genes or so, that you don't own it. It becomes the ownership of that company in Utah. The government of Ontario has said it would increase healthcare costs at least four times. So this whole issue of GMOs not only affects farmers, gardeners, or tree planters, it affects everybody in our society. So those are some of the important things. I haven't touched on the economic issues, but to give you one example of that, we can't sell one bushel of canola now to the European Union. We've lost our major markets around the world, and we have only about three countries that will buy it. Mexico, the United States, and the domestic consumption here in Canada. That's what's happened to our market. So the economic issue has been devastating to the canola farmers back home. And as I said, every bushel of canola that is now raised is contaminated. Why did an area that I would really want to get into, and why I want to bring this up, is to tell you what the results have been with the introduction of GMOs, or regulatory approval given in 1996. Why did farmers ever grow or start growing GMO seeds and plants. And this is what they were told. Number one, a bigger yielder. Number two, it would be more nutritious. And number three, less chemicals. And there were some other buzzwords. They also said we'd now always have sustainable agriculture. We'd now also be able to feed a hungry world. These were great words. And what happened? Within 1 year and 2 years after the introduction, within 1 year, through cross-pollination, we already had the super wheat canola plant established. And what is a super wheat? Monsanto was not the only company in 1996 to introduce GMOs. You also had the varieties of Liberty Link and Pursuit Smart, along with Monsanto's Roundup Ready canola. Within the first year in the Peace River country of Alberta, one farmer had seeded these three varieties, and through cross-pollination, all those three genes were now in one plant, which now takes a multitude of new chemicals, more toxic chemicals, more highly powerful chemicals, to try and kill this new super wheat. This super wheat now is not only in canola fields, it now has spread across Western Canada, and you'd be hard pressed to find any field without it. Whether you're a wheat farmer, a barley farmer, oats, it's in every field it has spread. So you have to use new and more powerful chemicals to try and control it. So, and it's gone into organic fields and so on. So that is what's happened now. We're using more chemicals ever than before. Not only that, but Monsanto has been able to get another regulatory approval from the federal government to increase the residue in the grains that they spray with it now from 17 parts per million to 100 parts per million. So as a result of that, with the residue, further other sales are, we can no longer make to many other countries. So you are now eating, especially in some of the grains, more residue than you ever did before. So now we have more chemical use. What about yield? Our yield is way down, 15% on soybeans, at least 6.2% on canola. What about the nutritional value? The value, the nutritional value has gone in some cases down to half. So now we have more chemical use, we have poor quality or less nutritious, and as I said, more chemical use and less yield. This is what the results have been with the introduction of GMOs. Back on the prairies now, Monsanto never says, but I hear it in many other countries, yet when I go, whether it's Asia or Africa, this is what they no longer say, less chemicals now, or more nutritious, or bigger yielders. They now say it's a better tool for farmers to control weeds. That's what they say now. Believe me, my wife and I were canola growers for half a century. We didn't need the Monsantos of the world to grow a canola crop, and we don't need the Monsantos of the world to feed hungry people around the world. We now have at least 1.5 times more food than is what needed to feed everybody a decent meal around the world. What it takes to feed people and hungry people are politics, economics, transportation, and basically the will and desire to do it. That's what feeds a hungry world. So those are some of the major issues. In the beginning, I touched on pharma plants. And to me, I think that's the greatest and biggest curse that's here with us now. We don't have labeling. And in Europe they have, and in about 40 countries of the world they do now have labeling. So people know what they are eating. They know what they're feeding to their children and their grandchildren. We don't have that in North America. And it's bad enough to eat a food then laced with GMOs in. But now to eat a food laced with a prescription type drug in it, I think is absolutely criminal. And I think it's criminal of our federal government to allow this to be done, not in confined enclosures, but in the wild and in the open. And I've had scientists from 3 different universities in 3 different states give me examples and tell me what was going on. The 6 major prescription drugs that are being produced at the present time and primarily now in sunflowers. And also they want to bring in GMO rice because apparently rice is a better crop to use for producing prescription type drugs. Now, I'll try and give you and try, I think I have a list of the drugs here and I'll give them to you. I thought I was organized. But anyway, I think I can do it from memory. Number one, industrial enzymes. Number two, blood thinners. Number three, blood clotters. Number four, growth hormones. And another one is contraceptive drugs. These are already being produced in North America by plants. There's also plastic being produced by corn. Now, these are some of the examples a doctor has given me at a meeting in Oregon. And this is the examples he gave. He said, if a person had major surgery, and then you eat a food laced with a blood thinner, what would the results be? Another example he gave me, he said, if a woman is pregnant, and then she ate a food laced with a contraceptive drug, what would the results be? This is going on at the present time. I mentioned plastics. Already a lot of plastic is being made from corn. Genes put in that the corn will produce this plastic. I often say this, that if you now buy a box of cornflakes and you take it home, and you're better off to throw the cornflakes away and eat the box. You might be safer, you know. But this is what's being produced by plants now. So it's absolutely criminal for this to be allowed. There's over 300 test plots last year in the United States and Canada producing drugs from plants. Those are some of the issues. Now, the Terminator gene has been mentioned. There's another gene also out at the present time, and it's called the cheater gene. And traitor gene are basically the same thing. Cheater gene, as you may know, is a gene that's put into a seed, and when the seed becomes a plant, and the seed that is produced, the seed will be sterile. But what they don't tell you, that if the Terminator gene is used, that in the flowering stage, in the pollination stage, that Terminator gene can also pollinate into your neighbor's crop, which will terminate the fertility of your neighbor's seed also, whether you're an organic farmer or conventional farmer. Now, what is the cheater gene? The cheater gene is this. A plant will not produce a seed unless you spray a chemical on it. And when the chemical is sprayed on, if you have in a seed, which will both have the Terminator gene in and the cheater gene in it, okay, you plant your crop, the seed becomes a plant, you have to use a chemical on it to make it produce a seed. When the chemical is sprayed on and the seed is produced, then the Terminator gene kicks in and renders the seed sterile. So that gives them complete control over the seed, the fertility of the seed, and the farmer will absolutely not be able to use his seed from year to year. So those are just some of the things that are out there. Now, in February, I should maybe just touch on that, 17 people from the Department of Environment were in Bangkok at the United Nations. And this is the biological conference. The United States does not belong to this particular type of conference, but they were using the Canadian delegation to further the commercialization in Asia of the Terminator gene. Our Canadian government. Who were they associating with? Monsanto's, the biotech companies of the world, especially the United States. They were using the Canadians. And I happened to be in Bangkok, and I was asked to give a presentation on that Friday afternoon before the final vote was taken. And believe me, I really went after the Canadian delegation, that they were not speaking for the Canadian people. Who authorized them to try and get commercialization of the destroying of the fertility of seeds of the Asian people or people around the world? This is what the Canadian people were doing, our delegation from the Department of Environment. And the Canadian anthem, that vote that Friday afternoon was lost. The Canadian delegation lost their motion. Thank God for that. I don't want to go on too long, but there's another part, this whole issue of the introduction of GMOs. And this has not happening in some third world country. It is happening here in both our countries. The stress that it puts on people, that fear. We were watched, my wife and I were watched day after day after day. When we worked in our fields, they would sit along the road and watch us what we did all day long. How did we know they were Monsanto people? We were able to get license numbers and then trace who it belonged to. Sometimes it was Monsanto's own personnel, sometimes it was Monsanto's gene police. In the United States, they used Pinkerton Investigation Service. So they would watch us. They would even come and park in the driveway at our home. And when my wife would come out, they would take off. Phone calls, you better watch it. They're going to get you. This is what we had to go through, that whole fear. And believe me, in 1999 and the year 2000, if I had somebody helping me on the farm, we never went into a tractor. We never went into a combine unless we had a rifle with us. That's how much that fear was and how we were threatened. And that didn't only affect me, it affected my neighbors. Because my neighbors were told, if you support Percy Schmeiser, we're going to come after you and we'll do to you exactly what we've done to him. I was speaking at the parliament in South Africa a few years back, and Monsanto heard that I was speaking to the legislature there, and they flew up a person by the name of Walla Green, their representative in South Africa. And he demanded that he also could have some time to speak to the legislature. And they gave him 5 minutes. And basically, in those 5 minutes, he bombed out. He said there was no such thing as cross-pollination. There was no such thing as direct seed movement. And he got laughed at and by the African Parliament. But coming out of the assembly, we ran face-to-face into each other. And he shook his fist in my face. And he said, nobody stands up to Monsanto. And we're going to get you. And we're going to destroy you. And when you get back to Canada, he said, you're going to be in bigger trouble. And I thought, my God, what bigger trouble could I be in with a lawsuit? But sure enough, when I got back to Canada 3 weeks later, another lawsuit against me, which a lot of people did not realize. This lawsuit was for $1 million because they said I was arrogant, I was stubborn, and I wouldn't do what Monsanto wanted. So I had another $1 million lawsuit against me. Okay. So then I had another court battle, and which probably cost me another $20,000-$30,000 to fight. And the trial judge that presided at my first case was allowed to decide on that $1 million court cost that Monsanto wanted. And what did that trial judge award Monsanto? $153,000 to pay for their court costs. And thank God the Supreme Court of Canada said I didn't have to pay anything to Monsanto. Otherwise, I would have had another $153,000 bill. But what happened in South Africa, my wife was with me, and she heard what Wally Green, the Monsanto's rep, said to me. She got so excited, she fell down the steps, and she broke her shoulder. So she ended up in hospital in South Africa, and she couldn't fly home until, for another 5 days. So that is what people are going through. And my case was not alone. In court, Monsanto's biotechnology manager from Saskatoon said it was a test case to see how far Monsanto could exercise patent law over farmers' rights. So basically, that is what they wanted. They got what they wanted through the courts. And so what I am saying is that farmers have no rights under patent law. The rights go to the corporations. And that's what we have to get the government or the Parliament of Canada to change. I have a few overheads I'm going to show. And they'll show Monsanto's police, gene police, in a farmer's field against his permission, which I was able to get. But before I show that, I'd like to say this. What kind of a legacy? My wife is 73, I'm 74. And another opinion or a stance that we took was this. What kind of a legacy do we want to leave to our children and grandchildren? I started using chemicals in 1947 after the war. And believe me, after 50 years of using chemicals, we've seen, my wife and I have seen, the destruction it has done to our environment, to human health, the high rate of cancer. I don't have a single neighbor alive. I'm the only one left that is alive that has not died from cancer. So we've seen that. And so what kind of a legacy do we want to continue to leave to our children, our grandchildren? Do we all here want to leave a legacy of land and our food and our soil and our air full of poison, our water? I don't think none of us want that. We want to leave a legacy of land and food, air and water, and so on, without poisons. And that's why Louise and I have committed ourselves, as long as we have that health, we'll continue to fight for those rights of farmers that they are always, always able to use their own seed. So again, I know there's many other areas that could cover the food issue, the environmental issue, but I would be here for 2 days. So again, I hope that I have brought you a message, and we will continue to bring that message because we feel so strongly that those rights of farmers to be able to use your own seed from year to year will always be maintained. And if we lose those rights, we'll become serfs of the land and we're back to a feudal system. Again, thank you to the organizers for bringing me here, and it's a great pleasure to talk to you this afternoon. Thank you very much.
This has been a special CFRU 93.3 FM presentation. For more information or to help support Percy's Legal Fund, go to his website, www.percyschmeiser.com.